Hello and welcome to episode 107 of the Blue Cup Tools podcast. I am Francisco Gonzalez, also known as Grundislav, and with me, as always...
Hello, I am Ben Chanloff, also known as 304. How are you this evening, morning, Francisco?
I'm well. I'm well rested. I'm awake. I'm ready to podcast, even though it's hot outside and I have my windows open, so there might be a little bit more outside ambient noise than there usually is.
I can hear a bird cheeping.
Cheep, 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 cheep. I said that to a chipmunk the other day.
The chipmunks cheep.
No, but they chip.
Do they chip?
They chip, yeah. They go, eh! I was in Prospect Park and there was a chipmunk. And so there was chipping happening. And so then I said, cheep, cheep, cheep. And I laughed to myself because I was the only one who got the reference.
Who else was going to laugh?
Exactly. Oh. Never mind. No podcast. I'm being arrested.
What's your name again?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. It's the end of the week. I had a good week this week. I actually finished painting the last scene for the section I've been working on in Unavowed, the 83rd scene for the game. So good. I'm onto character design now. So, you know.
I did a scene this week too, but only one.
What's that story?
I said I painted a scene too this week, but only one, because I've actually had people alpha testing Lamplight City this week. And I've had one very diligent tester who has emailed me every morning to tell me that they have played one case per day and their reactions to it. And I thought, well, that's
a good way
to
break it up.
Yeah. They've been the only one that's responded so far, but I'm hoping still that the other ones will as well in a timely manner.
It takes time.
It does.
Yeah. But yeah, I had a good productive week. The last couple, since I've been home, I've been very productive. I sort of locked myself away in my, not locked, but you know, shut myself away in my room and sort of got to work.
Yeah, and I've been trying to do the same thing. I found that it's been very helpful.
Yeah, and so I had a good few weeks and I relaxed tonight after work with a bit of TIE Fighter on my old DOS PC and a bit of Lynx, and now I'm podcasting. It's all good.
That's good. That's good.
Mm. Yeah.
So we decided that we're not going to do the whole what have you been playing thing as a segment of our podcast anymore because it takes too long and no one really cares. And we figure that
a lot of the stuff that we'll be playing will come up naturally in discussion of specific things anyway. So yeah.
So with that said, let's get right into our topic, which is...
Let's do it. No segues. We don't need segues.
No segues. Just straight in. I mean, it might be a shorter podcast, but who cares? People are busy and they don't have time to listen to a podcast for an hour and a half.
We don't need a segue. We can jump in without too much difficulty.
Exactly. So our topic this week...
Do you see what I did there?
Yes, I did. Good. And I chose not to acknowledge it.
I'm upset, but okay, continue.
I'm sorry to have hurt your sensibilities.
Dang. A good god dang.
So our topic this week is challenge in games. Specifically, I guess, adventure games.
Specifically adventure games. Yeah, well, it's interesting because unlike reflex or skill-based games, adventure games, you can't really add more enemies or take away some ammo with a difficulty level. You can't make bullets hurt more or less with a difficulty level. It's adventure games. You can't just go, oh, we'll put more items in. It doesn't quite work like that.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I can think of offhand two adventure games that have a difficulty setting that you can choose. Actually, I can think of three, but I haven't played the third one.
Well, there's the Thimbleweed Park recently, obviously. That's the one. There's Mega Monkey Mode.
Yes, and there's Hard Mode in Monkey Island 2.
It's interesting that they actually chose to have that. I kind of guess I get why. Because they probably had feedback from people going, this is too challenging. And, you know, trying to think of ways to deal with that. Because some people, here's the thing with difficulty, and you will have probably experienced it just as much as I have, and I think a lot of other developers have, is that you'll get two pieces of feedback reliably on any adventure game ever. And that is the first one, this is way too easy and short. Mm-hmm. And the second one is, this is way too hard and I give up.
Yeah, absolutely.
Every single game gets that feedback.
Yep.
So, yeah, you know, and I get why, because sometimes it's hard. Like, I remember, I think I've told this story before, but The Secret of Monkey Island, I remember being stuck for a very long time when you're on the ship to get mm-hmm. to Monkey Island because I didn't open the cereal box.
Right,
which
yeah.
is such an obvious... It's like, I got all the other stuff, but I missed the most obvious thing, and I was stuck there for a long time. When I finally got it, I was like, oh my goodness, how did I miss that? So, you know,
well,
I get
I mean,
why people get stuck on obvious stuff.
Yeah. Well, with the Monkey Island thing, in that particular instance, I think it has to do a lot with like what we were talking about the other day. You and I were talking about Discworld and mm. how difficult the puzzles, if you want to even call them puzzles, in Discworld are.
Interactions.
Correct. In that section in Monkey Island, you have quite a few inventory items. Granted, not as many as you do in Discworld. And I think one of the things that happens in adventure games is you have so much to do. You have all these inventory items, especially in Monkey Island. You have 9 different verbs that you can try on every single one of these inventory items. You have all these hotspots, even though it's only like a 5 or 6 screen area, the ship. Mm-hmm. But you have all these mm-hmm. hotspots that you can try the different inventory items on. So it becomes such an overwhelming amount of interactions that you think to yourself, I can't possibly sit here and click on everything. I guess I give up. So the obvious thing maybe becomes less obvious. It becomes obfuscated. See what I did there? Yes. In just the sheer amount of choice that you have. I think that happens. Oh, go ahead.
I think the fact too that you're talking about distraction and obfuscation, I think I was probably misdirected by the fact, well, I know I was, by the fact that you were making a recipe.
Oh, that's
with ingredients.
That's also
and the
true.
Cereal was food item, so I was not thinking of the prize in the box. I was thinking, you know, let's pour this in with the rest of the recipe. And
yeah.
The fact
I can't
that
remember.
Didn't work, I was like, oh, well, now what?
Yeah. I can't remember because it's been ages since I played The Secret of Monkey Island. But if you look at the cereal box, does he make any sort of comment about how it has a prize inside? I know that he makes a comment about how, like, it makes the roof of your mouth get all weird because it's supposed to be Captain Crunch. But
yeah, I think he just goes through the ingredients or something. Oh, it's been a long
time
since I looked at it. Yeah.
That's right. He goes through the ingredients because it's most of those weird chemical ingredients that the
recipe
calls for. Right. Yeah, see, if he made a comment, and I mean, we can't really say this without verifying, but if he made a comment about how it comes with a toy prize inside or whatever, then that would be a little bit more, I think, fair. Or less challenging or whatever, but I mean, we're talking about challenge, not fairness. Yeah. Although I think when you talk about challenges in adventure games, you have to talk about fairness, because if it's an unfair puzzle, I think that is separate from being a challenging puzzle. Like, you can have a challenging puzzle, yeah, as long as it makes sense and it's fair. But if you just expect the player to know something or expect the player to just kind of like come up with something, then that's not fair. Like, yeah, it just goes back to the old rule of adventure game puzzle design, which is never put in something that requires any outside information, that requires your player to leave your game to verify that outside information, because that's just not fair. It's a pain in the ass. I mean, nowadays, you know, I could, you know, I have my phone on my desk at all times, so I can just load up Wikipedia on my phone or whatever, or Google, look something up if I'm playing a game. I don't need to quit out of it. But still, the idea that you have to do that is terrible.
Yeah, that's a pretty fundamental one that's been discussed quite a lot, and I agree that it's good to keep games insular.
Yeah,
in
terms you never. Of, I've always, I always you bring up Hugo's House of Horrors when we talk about this. But
correct.
Well, we won't reiterate. But yes, don't do something like that. I actually, as a little anecdote, designed a puzzle. Well, puzzle. A challenge, an obstacle, if you will. In my game, Lamplight City, just yesterday, where I had this issue where I had a sequence of events where you basically had to talk to a character, you found out a piece of information that led you to another character, you went and talked to that character, they gave you a piece of information that you then had to verify with the first character, they then gave you a piece of information that you then had to talk to that other character about again. So it was a case of what I like to call conversation tennis, which is not fun because you're just going back and forth between two characters talking about different things. There's no challenge in it. It's stupid.
Mm.
So I decided to break it up with a bit of discovery where you talk to... First of all, I cut out two parts of the conversation, so you really only have to talk to the first character once and the second character a second time. You find out this piece of information from the first character, you go speak to the second character, and you try and ask them about the thing, but they are resistant, and you have to try and convince them to open up, which was part of the initial thing, but I repurposed it. Anyway, so I added a thing where you have to go and discover something and get an item, and then be able to present that item to the person, which will then cause them to open up. However, in that puzzle where you have to find the thing, it requires you to... I have to tread lightly here to avoid any spoilers, but also make it sound intelligible. As part of that puzzle, you have to find an item which is a certain color, and the person that you have talked to that gives you the information identifies the item by that color. And I thought, well, what would be more interesting if the character flat out says, oh, it was this color, or if the character says, oh, it was the same color as something else. And I thought, well, this character in question works in a kitchen. They're a kitchen servant. So obviously they would compare it to something in the kitchen that they see. So I said, all right, well, it's the same color as my stew spices. So then I was like, all right, well, actually, at first I was thinking about naming a spice by name because the thing in question is orange. So I was going to be like, oh, it's the color of how do you pronounce that? Turmeric?
Turmeric.
Turmeric, right.
So turmeric's quite yellow.
Well, it's like a yellow orangey sort of thing.
It's yellow.
Okay, fine. Anyway, I was
considering... Turmeric's what they use, I believe, to turn American mustard yellow.
Oh, interesting. Well, yeah, anyway, the point was that I was considering a specific spice color. And so I thought, okay, well, I could do this, but at the same time, if you don't know what color that spice is, even though you might think it's common knowledge, there might be some players who don't know what that is. So I just avoided the problem altogether by having her just say the generic, it's the same color as my stew spices. And then I added a little hotspot in the room, which I'll obviously have to paint in later, but a little hotspot of spices, which are orange. So you look at it and you're like, oh, those are the stew spices. So that in the game tells you what you need to know. And so there's a challenge there, but it requires you to examine and observe and pay attention, and it'll give you all the information you need. It's not something that requires you to have any sort of outsider knowledge. That's my ramble done. You can continue if you like.
I think it's interesting, like, the fact that turmeric can be seen as either yellow how I see it or orange how you see it. I mean, there's obviously different shades of turmeric. Makes me think that you've got to be careful there.
Exactly, you know, yeah.
What one person sees as yellow, another person might see as orange. Or maybe they've seen turmeric in different things.
Right.
And, yeah, it's you got to be careful with that.
I mean, I googled orange spices, and that came up first, and I looked at it on Wikipedia, and I was like, yeah, that's pretty orange, and it's like, yeah, it can be orange. So I was like, all right, I'll go with this, but
see, I'll use turmeric to turn, if I'm cooking a rice dish, I'll use turmeric to make it yellow.
Sure.
And it makes it a really, really yellow.
Right. So,
you gotta be, you know.
So this is a prime example of Yeah, you have to be careful with variety and things. So when in doubt, just make it generic.
It's interesting, you know, what we define as a puzzle, because when we get to a game and you get to a sliding tile puzzle or something like that, you go, oh, this is, you know,
a sliding tile. That's not a puzzle. That's an activity.
But here's the thing, Francisco. Traditionally, what we call puzzles are things like jigsaw puzzles, crossword puzzles, sliding tile puzzles. You know, those are what we used to call puzzles before we had adventure games. And now the stuff that we put in adventure games that we call puzzles are rarely, they don't resemble. You know, if you go onto YouTube and you look up puzzles, it's usually get this thing out of a jar or, you know, unlink these two metal shapes and stuff like that. Those are puzzles. Mm-hmm. So what we call puzzles are a whole new thing again. There's no history of, you know, it's not the bit of wood that you spin one way, then flip it over, then spin it the other way, and it comes apart magically because of how the pins connect. It's observing a scenario in a different way, you know. So we say all the time, oh, that's not a puzzle, but actually a lot of the time they are what puzzles are and what we call puzzles. If you put a jigsaw puzzle in the game, people are like, oh, this is just filler. But it's a puzzle. It's a jigsaw puzzle. Like I used to do them as kids.
Sure.
It's a different kind of puzzle. So, you know, I'm hesitant to say, oh, that's not a puzzle about stuff like sliding tile puzzles, because they are traditionally puzzles. You know, whether it's I played a game recently that I gave up on at the very, very end, because...
That's a shame.
The very final puzzle was a massive 360-degree Minesweeper game.
Oh, what game was that?
Subject 13, and it was tough.
I saw you tweeting about that, and I was very... I saw that there was, like, something where you had to do math, and I just did not feel like that was something that would be enjoyable in any way, shape, or form.
Well, see, I like doing math puzzles in games. I really do. Because you're solving a problem, you know, and you can see the stuff laid out in front of you, so you solve the problem. And I really liked...
Does the game make you show your work?
No.
Good. I hate that. I was never good at math. I always used to copy the homework off of Amar Patel.
That's why you didn't like having to show your work.
Exactly.
That's why teachers make you show your work so that you can't just copy it.
Well,
or accidentally arrive at a correct answer. But yeah, I don't mind math puzzles, you know. And I guess I grew up playing Myst and Riven and stuff like that, which aren't necessarily math puzzles a lot of the time, but they're more sort of abstract puzzling than like Day of the Tentacle or, you know, Sam and Max or Monkey Island or anything like that. But yeah, it's interesting to me because some people clearly love that type of game. You know, there's a circuit board puzzle in Resonance that I remember alpha testing that. And of the group of testers, I was the only one to solve that puzzle. And I was really proud of myself for solving it because it was, you know, I had to work it out on paper with a pencil.
Was that the one right at the beginning at the lab with the wire?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. That was a hard one.
Yeah. But I genuinely enjoyed solving that, and there are people that will enjoy solving that stuff, just as there are people that will enjoy mapping a maze out. But sure. I think the important thing to know is that, you know, do you really need the maze in there, or do you really need do you really believe that it adds to the game? I don't know. The good thing about Resonance is that the circuit puzzle was optional. You know, that was a very smart decision.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And I mean, I kind of did the same thing in A Golden Wake at the beginning at the land auction, where you have you can either do the logic puzzle or you can do the persuasion thing, and the persuasion thing is much easier.
I can't remember what the logic puzzle was.
It was, you had to match people's houses you had to match the people to what house they would best fit at based on their description and their wants and their... It was a classic, like, Highlights Magazine logic puzzle. And originally I wanted to have that be required, like you would have to do the persuasion puzzle and the logic puzzle and a third one, which I never ended up designing. But then I thought, this is going to be too much too soon and people are not going to want to do this, so I figured just do it either or.
Yeah, it's interesting. We like to have the gameplay work in time with the story, and there's a point where it's not when you're doing that sort of puzzle, when you have something challenging. There's something I wanted to bring up, and it's interesting to me. I think there's two different types of density, I guess, or breadth, and one of them is having a puzzle that has a lot of elements, a lot of layers. You have to do a lot of different things, and that can, you know, be quite involved. And the other is having a lot of area to explore and having to find stuff over a wide area. I think they both work individually, but I think if you've got a very complex puzzle combined with a large area to explore in order to solve it, that's too overwhelming. And I think the dig does that quite a bit. You know, you've got this massive area, and then you've got these not needlessly complex, but you know, you're overwhelmed by all this space, and then you've got a very tough puzzle to solve at the same time.
Well,
I think that's one of the...
I'm trying to think of examples of that in the dig, because I mean, the dig does sort of have that, I agree, but I kind of think that at the same time, the dig does a pretty decent job of limiting you as far as where you can go. Because I mean, the very first area is just space. I mean, it's the shuttle and it's the asteroid.
That doesn't count.
That's easy. And then it goes...
Count. You don't have to solve anything.
Okay, there. Well, once you get on the surface of the planet, your main goal becomes trying to dig the hole that Brink ultimately falls down. And
sure, that doesn't...
But
really
there's only a few screens.
Either.
Right, and then once you get into the Nexus...
That's
it's when
it gets...
Well, but the Nexus... Keep in mind that at that very first part in the Nexus, like, you can walk all around, but you can't open any of the doors until you turn the power on. And there's only really, there's that screen, and you can go into, like, the, I think you can go to that, like, the area where there's all the water, but I don't remember if you can. And then you can go underground.
You've got the sun and moon appearing and stuff like that.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, like, you can only... Well, the sun and moon puzzle you have to solve right there, and you get trapped inside the observatory after you solve the puzzle. But
I did...
Like, the thing is, like, each spire opens up to you as you go along. It's not like every single spire is open to you at all times, and that means you can go everywhere and... Like, I mean, the dig has its flaws, certainly, but I... do think that it does that well of, like, not giving you the entire map, if as it were, open. Like, you do get a feeling of satisfaction from solving each spire and, like, turning on each light bridge.
But what I'm trying to say is that if you feel like you've missed something and you're not sure what you're missing, and they don't seal off the places you already successfully solved, then you know, towards the second or the final third of the game, you're wandering all over the damn place.
Yeah, that's true. If you're left with if you have a lot of ground to cover that you've opened up, then sure. Yeah,
and if you feel you've missed something and you've got all those scenes to walk over, and there's a lot, you know, whereas something like Full Throttle, it's more progressive. It seals you off as you go along.
Right.
Same with Fate of Atlantis. You know, it seals you off and you sort of progress like that.
Yeah.
So... You know, and because the digs puzzles are quite complex, another thing about the dig is a game where a lot of the puzzles have many layers, and sometimes a layer can hide the other layers unnecessarily. A classic one is the one where you're trying to program the drone to fetch the lens.
I'd say that's probably the worst puzzle in the dig. And not because it's bad, but just because there's no clues to indicate what's going on. Like, it's the most trial and error puzzle that there is. It's probably the most mist-like puzzle that there is.
But the biggest problem that I have with it is that there's no uniformity to the buttons.
Right. They're all different
shapes.
Buttons,
you've got four buttons that do a different direction.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't they be made to look the same way? Right. I understand alien technology, but there's no... They just felt like there was little logic behind that, you know? So that's probably the biggest problem I have with that, is that that's a needless layer of, you know, trickery on top of an already fairly tricky puzzle. If it didn't have that, those, if the buttons were uniform or even arrow shaped, because come on, you know, I feel it would have been a lot easier to solve. Not too easy, but the actual puzzle itself is enough. I think you didn't need that extra layer.
Exactly. I agree. And I mean, considering it's so early in the game,
And it's easy to feel when you get stuck at something, they're like, oh, I've missed something. Let me go look around more.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So if you're not.
Well, I mean, it's like the chalk puzzle in Shardlight, which we've talked about to death, but it's another example
I've been
of
trying
like,
to avoid it because that's the example that you and I have really experienced firsthand.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, it's a puzzle that's hard. That's at the beginning of the game that people give up on. And it's got one layer that pretty much could have been cut and would not have, it would have been better for it, but whatever.
And I designed that puzzle and tested that puzzle outside of the game.
Yeah.
You know, and I tweaked it for hours, you know, getting feedback from people so that it worked well by itself. Mm-hmm. But then when you put it in a game where you can wander in a lot of places, let's face it, all of a sudden it becomes really, really needlessly complex.
Yep.
And, you know, like I said, we've talked that one to death, but
we have.
But yeah, I think that's important, is if you're going to have complex, intricate puzzles, make sure that the player isn't overwhelmed at the same time by a lot of elements where they think, well, if I've clearly missed something, mm-hmm. but now I've got 20 different locations that I have to go and look for the missed element in, you know. It's a point where it's just too overwhelming, like you said with Discworld. It's too overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much challenging as a complete lack of direction as to what comes next.
Yeah, there was a... I've mentioned it before, but there was a game, an AGS game that came out a while ago called Second Face, The Eye of Geltz is Watching Us, which is an amazing title, by the way. And the lore in the world was really interesting, too, like... There were an alien race that thought that the moon was this god called Geltz that was watching them, which is pretty, pretty interesting. But the intro was really long, and then when you are finally put in control, you are like the prince of this alien world, and you can walk around the entire kingdom and talk to everybody, and there's no real clear direction of what you have to do. And it just becomes overwhelming because you have such a large area to explore and no clear goals and, like, just... I gave up. I never played it, really, because I was just like, okay, this is a lot. I don't know what to do. I'll come back to this. And I never came back to it. So, it was challenging, but for a different reason. It was because there was too much to see and not enough to do, I guess.
I mean, it's interesting because ostensibly that's the format that Quest for Glory games have.
Yeah.
They let you just sort of go out to your heart's content. They don't really... I guess they sort of provide a bit of a goal, but most of the time they're like, well, this is stuff that's happening, but now you can go and climb a tree 50 times.
I mean, the Quest for Glory games, they are like that, yes, to an extent, but they do a pretty decent job of focusing you on like a specific location and figuring out what it is you have to do. I mean, like in Quest for Glory 1, I would say that's pretty much the only one where it just kind of dumps you in this place and it's like, okay, I want to be a hero. Well, what do I have to do? And you just sort of explore the town and talk to the people and they tell you about like the problems that are plaguing the valley. And then you go out and sort of stumble across things and solve them by being a hero. In Quest for Glory 2, it's a little bit more structured in that you get to the place and it's like, oh, well, explore Shapir and you explore the city. But then after a certain number of days, stuff starts happening and you have only a certain number of days to like defeat the elementals and all that stuff.
But that's still quite an interesting approach where they're just like, all right, just go and do what you want to your heart's content for now.
I mean, that's part of the appeal of the Quest for Glory games is that you get sent to these different lands in every game and you get to look around them. And like,
sure, but that's the exact thing that you were saying that you struggled with a second face. So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is that in a second face, it was just kind of like, okay, I'm the prince of this realm. Walk around the realm. And I didn't have, like, any overarching... Like, in Quest for Glory 1, I know it's, okay, well, I want to be a hero, so something's going to happen. In Quest for Glory 2, it's like, okay, well, this land needs a hero. Something's going to happen. In a second phase, it was just like, I'm the prince of this realm. That's it. So, yeah. So there was nothing that indicated that anything was going to happen, or there was nothing that indicated that there was some place I should go to maybe find out. Like, if I talk to the people, it's not like they said anything like, oh, this is what's wrong with the land. Like, they were just like, oh, hi, Prince. I don't know. It's been, like, almost 20 years since I played this game.
So you weren't so much challenged as lost, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess. But, yeah.
No, I'm just curious. I'm not saying that, you know, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with what you're saying. I'm just curious about comparing the two and seeing why you think one works and why you think the other doesn't. Yeah. You know, or why you struggled with one but welcomed the other.
Right. Well, also, I mean, it depends too if you play them in order or whatever, if you just jump in. But like the first Quest for Glory game I ever played was 3. And so in Quest for Glory 3, you show up to this, to Tarna, but you're also given this introduction and told that there's a problem in Tarna, and when you show up there, they tell you what the problem is, and the character tells you, okay, well, go feel free to, like, go to the inn and check in at the inn and explore, and if you go out of the town, don't go too far, because we have an appointment in 2 days, and then after those 2 days go by, you have the appointment, and then the plot sort of gets kicked forward. So...
Interesting.
Yeah. And it's kind of the same thing in 4, where, like, you end up in this cave you have to escape from, and then you go out, and then you figure out that the land is dangerous, and that you have things to do, and it sort of progresses naturally from there. So, yeah, the formula in question... I mean, I hesitate to even call it a formula, because it sort of was a formula, but every single Quest for Glory game is different in how it introduces you to the plot, which I think is pretty cool. But that doesn't really have to do...
Quest for Glory is also interesting in that there's not a lot of, I want to say, puzzle challenge. A lot of the times the challenge is stat related.
Yeah, kind of.
You know, or combat related. Like, you don't have enough stats to do this yet, but you know, if I work up to this,
right?
You know, which is very much a role playing way of looking. You know, role playing games have that thing where, you know, you get to a dungeon and you get beaten up and you think, all right, I'm not strong enough, I'll go and get stronger, then I'll come back here later, and that's kind of what shapes where you go.
Yeah,
you know.
And I think I might finally play Quest for Glory 4 this weekend. I think I'm ready to continue, because I've seen a lot of Twitter conversation about 5, and I'm like, yeah, I really want to go back and play 5, but I need to play 4 because I love 4 and I want to continue the saga of my wizard. Because I want to do the thermonuclear blast spell at the end of 5. That's the only reason playing as a wizard.
It's interesting, when I played Quest for Glory, you know, I didn't find the gameplay itself. I guess it was challenging in that, you know, you have to fight and you have to work that stuff out. And the combat not great, so you're trying to fight with the combat more than with the actual enemies. But
yeah, the combat is easily the worst part of the Quest for Glory series. It's only good in 2.
You've never played Shannara by the Coles, have you?
I have not.
The combat in that is far more pointless
than
the Quest for Glory game that I've played. And it's interesting.
That
Shannara
seems...
felt to me like Quest for Glory on a real budget, which is probably what it was.
That seems really weird, because I thought Shannara was more of an RPG than an adventure game.
No.
Really?
Oh, no. Oh. No.
You sound like someone who's been traumatized.
What gave you that idea, Francisco?
Oh, nothing. Anyway, please tell me more about Shannara and the pointless combat.
The combat is really felt tacked on, and there's very little of it, and it's really, like, every time I won, I was like, well, I didn't deserve that win, and every time I lost, I was like, I don't even know if I did lose. Like, it was just, it was...
You lost the moment you booted up Shannara.
You didn't need to learn anything. Yeah, but, yeah, anyway, that's an interesting comparison to see what the Coles were doing without much of a budget and, you know, in a different kind of series.
Yeah. Interesting.
I'm trying to think of other things in Challenge. I think one of the biggest problems that we have in Challenge, and we've covered this a lot, but it's worth covering here so that it's covered in our Challenge topic for people if they listen to this specifically to listen for Challenge, is that a lot of times when Challenge feels unfair, it's when an element changes or is introduced that's never been in the game before and isn't explained to us. An example is in the dig when you have to hold down a button for a bridge. I remember you saying that Jess got stuck on that and that you never got stuck on it. I remember getting stuck on that because I clicked it and nothing happened.
Right.
The game never tells you, and it's not consistent with anything else in the game. And that was very confusing to me. So, you know, that's if you do something, and, you know, let's talk about the goat puzzle in Broken Sword. There's no other point in the game where
you have to interact with your environment. Yeah.
In that particular sort of way that, you know, so it's when you've got inconsistency like that, you haven't taught the player, I guess you break their trust to an extent because they trust the first half hour of a game is getting used to how it works.
Right.
And if you introduce anything from beyond that, you really need to explain to them, you know, this is how it works. It's interesting when you sort of, if you watch John Romero play through a bit of Doom, which I think he did with JP from when JP was at Double Fine, and sort of just discussing some of the stuff, and he talks about how they put stuff in very obvious places so that the player would accidentally do stuff. Like you open a door and there's a bunch of enemies and there's a barrel there so that when the player shoots, they accidentally hit the barrel, the player realizes
that barrels
explode. You can shoot barrels and they explode. Right. Yeah, so it's teaching the player. You know, Half-Life 2 is a great example of teaching a player slowly, bit by bit, this is how you do something. And if you introduce something else without teaching the player, boy, that's frustrating.
Yeah.
So, yes, yeah, consistency is key to even Challenge. If you're going to introduce a challenge, either teach the player about it or have it consistent with the rest of the way that the player interacts with the game or you know, puts their input in.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that I get asked a lot is, you know, like, how do I make puzzles hard or how do I make challenging puzzles in an adventure game, and like, how, what's the best way to, like, yeah, just make puzzles? And I never really know how to answer that question because I'm not really a puzzle guy. You're more of the puzzle design guy than I am. To me, it just, if it's something that's an obstacle, I think of puzzles more as obstacles than as anything else. Like, I actually kind of wonder who coined the term puzzles for adventure games, or who decided to use the term puzzles for adventure game challenges or obstacles or whatever you want to call them.
Well, I think if you look back, I'm not sure about text adventures, if they called them puzzles then, but if you look at, for example, Mystery House, there's a great puzzle in Mystery House where you've got two different pieces of paper and you have to basically combine them, and it really feels like a puzzle. So I wonder if that's where it got started.
How do you have to combine them? I've never played Mystery House. Actually, that's not true. I tried playing Mystery House. You were there. We tried playing Mystery House. Remember? And I couldn't figure out any of the parser commands because it didn't understand anything.
I just sat there and watched it. I'm trying to look at it. I have to show it to you afterward. But basically, you've got two different notes, and one of them is the top half. You know the thing with Primordia with Ink and.
Oh, it's been a long time since I played Primordia. I don't remember.
Okay, so one of the notes is the top half of the letters, and the other of the notes is the bottom half of the letters. Okay. So you kind of had to draw the two and then put them together. It really feels like solving a puzzle.
I see. Okay.
So I wonder if that... I can't... I mean, that was way before I was born, so, you know, I wasn't around then, and I don't know my game history that well, but I wonder if that was the sort of... But I think text adventures had puzzles. But a lot of the times, I don't know. I really don't know, Francisco, who decided to call them puzzles. I really don't know. I've heard people call them riddles as well. And sometimes there are riddles in games, you know. Like Baldur's Gate or Conquest of Camelot or, you know.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's
or the Longbow. Yeah. Both now available on GOG. But yeah, I think that, like, puzzle design... Did you just laugh at my little advertisement?
Yes.
The challenge of designing puzzles that are challenging is a challenge in it of itself. See what I did there?
That was great.
Thank you. It's just... It's hard, because, like, for me, designing puzzles, I never feel like puzzles should be unfair, so I try not to make them unfair, but then they end up becoming too easy for some people. I don't understand what it is people want out of challenging puzzles a lot of the time, I guess. Because I don't like playing adventure games where the puzzles are ridiculously hard and unfair and stupid and quote-unquote challenging.
But, so you've gone from one extreme to the other.
That's true, I have.
You've gone from easy to ridiculous.
Let's do this. Let's look at some examples of puzzles that change based on what difficulty mode you select in Monkey Island 2 and in Curse. I can think of two prime examples. One of them
is I'm trying to find this mystery house thing.
Okay, anyway, well, continue. I'll talk while you look for mystery house. Well, I know I can remember off the top of my head. I remember that in Monkey Island 2, if you select easy mode, so at the beginning when you're looking for the ingredients for the voodoo doll, there's the puzzle where you have to get Largo's bra by, you have to get the bucket and you have to fill it with mud and you have to put it, you have to close Largo's door and put the bucket of mud on top of it. And then when he walks, you hide, and when he walks through the door, he gets the bucket of mud on him and gets his clothes dirty. And then you have to go look at the cutscene in the laundromat and see that he's going to go pick it up. And then you go back to his room, close the door again. He's put his claim ticket behind the door. You take the claim ticket, you give it to the laundry guy, and you get his bra. Now, that's a challenging puzzle, and I can think of a few reasons why, how it can be a little unfair. I think having to close his door twice is a bit much. I think the finding the claim ticket could have been put in a better location, maybe. For one thing. But, like, it's not super hard. It's not like a super hard stretch of logic to figure out that you have to put the bucket of mud over the door. But it's still a little out there. And I don't know why that is. But anyway, if you play on easy mode, if you go inside Largo's room, there's just a clean, starched white shirt right there on his bed for you to pick up. So you don't even have to do any bit of that puzzle. So that goes from being kind of a challenging puzzle to being completely easy. The other puzzle that I can think of from Curse of Monkey Island is the puzzle where you have to get Captain Blondebeard's gold tooth. So in Mega Monkey mode, you have to first give him Jawbreaker, which actually that's there's twofold to this, because in Mega Monkey mode, in order to get the Jawbreaker, you have to physically use the hand on Cutthroat Bill, which Guybrush gives him a pat on the back and he starts choking, and then you have to interact with him again and he hits him again and he spits out the Jawbreaker. And then you take the Jawbreaker, you give it to Captain Blondebeard, who eats it, and he says, "Oh, my tooth is loose." And then you give him the gum, and then he chews the gum, and then you pop it with the pin, and then you pick up the gold tooth, which has fallen on the floor. But then, if you walk out the door with the gold tooth, Blondebeard's like, "Wait, let me see what you have." And if you have the tooth, he takes it back from you. So what you have to do is, you have to combine the tooth with the gum, and then inhale helium, and then use the gum so that you blow a bubble and it flies out the window, and then you have to pan for gold in the mud puddle outside. What a dumb puzzle. Actually, it's not that. It's kind of, I don't know. Maybe nostalgia is tinting my memories of it, but it's, I think the stretch there is the idea of having to use helium to make a balloon, because if you inhale helium and you blow a bubble, it's not going to be a helium balloon. I wonder if anyone's ever tried that.
I don't know. I don't really want to know. I can't find this.
Yeah. But anyway, if you play it, it's all right. If you play it in regular mode, first of all, you actually don't have to do the thing with Cutthroat Bill. Like, Guybrush does it automatically, I think. Just in, like, dialogue with him, if you ask him about the Jawbreaker. Or actually, I think it's when you, like, stop talking to him or something. He automatically just, like, pats him on the back. Which initiates the puzzle chain there to get the Jawbreaker. But then in regular mode, when you do all that, you don't have to do the helium thing, because when you pop the balloon and pop the bubble and you take the tooth and you just walk out, Blondebeard doesn't say anything. So you don't have to do the extra step of the helium thing. So it seems like in Mega Monkey mode, they just added extra steps to the puzzles, whereas in Monkey Island 2, they just kind of cut the puzzles out completely. I'm trying to think of other examples, but I can't right now.
I think a lot of the times if I'm designing a puzzle and I think this needs something more, I'll just try to add another layer. I won't add more puzzles or anything like that. I'll just add another layer. Right. You know, and I think some of my favorite puzzles ever are the simplest, you know, that I've designed anyway. Like, I don't know if you remember Shifter's Box, but there was this puzzle I did in that where you've got four lamps of differing heights and you find a key under a rock, but the key doesn't fit the door. But the bumps on the key are of different heights. And if you look at the bumps of the key, you realize you have to turn the lamps on in the right order.
Mm.
And it's such a simple idea. But when I thought of it, I was like, oh man, this is a really great puzzle. Like, it's one of those moments when I'm like, this is a great puzzle. People are going to love this. And when I put it in the game, everyone said to me, oh man, I love this puzzle. And I was like, it's just a simple correlation between elements. Mm-hmm. But it was one of those moments where there's misdirection because you've got a locked door and you've got a key that doesn't unlock it.
Right.
So you think, all right, the key doesn't work in the door. What does this key do? It obviously unlocks the door because that's what keys do, but how does it unlock the door? So let's take another look at the key, you know. And it's just adding another layer of, you know, this is the key that tells you how to unlock the door. It's just a very unconventional way of unlocking the door, you know. And I liked that. That's kind of the kind of puzzle that I design, is puzzles that show you a pattern and rely on you picking up on that pattern, you know.
Right.
Or what's different in the pattern or something like that. That was what I did a lot of. And it's been a long time since I've designed puzzles. Or since I'm kind of rusty, you know, and I'm just starting to try my hand at it again. And it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough to make a challenging but fair-feeling puzzle. It's interesting. I watched Kelsey play some of a project of mine, and I've always hated watching people play my puzzles because it's always frustrating. You think you made something clear, and you clearly didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I was taking a bunch of notes of stuff that I thought was very clear that she was totally not getting. So sometimes the stuff that needs to be communicated to the player is stuff that you didn't realize needs to be communicated. It's very hard until you see someone failing at a puzzle to understand why that puzzle doesn't work. And I think that's a really good thing, is if you can watch someone totally fresh play your game, you'll see pretty quickly why certain things don't work at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially me when I design weird stuff.
Well, yeah.
You know, so
I guess.
Yeah, but yeah, no, it was interesting to me to watch someone get past the standard puzzles pretty quickly with interaction and stuff like that. But as soon as I incorporated new elements, just be clicking all over the place, and I'm like, no, that's not how it works, but not saying anything, and someone completely breaking the simplest stuff just because I hadn't communicated certain things clearly. So again, I think sometimes what you think might be the challenging part of a game isn't the challenging part. It'll be the the little stuff, you know.
Right. Yeah, like I mean,
with the
dig
and having to hold a damn button down.
Yeah, yeah. One of the biggest issues I've been having with Lamplight City is figuring out where to put the puzzles. Because, like, as you know, there's like different leads to follow, and part of me is like, well, I want to have interesting, challenging puzzles, but at the same time, like, I don't want it to just be like, well, you'll know you're on the right track because you get a puzzle. But at the same time, I'm like, well, I don't want to waste my time designing a puzzle for a lead that turns out to be false. Like, there's that example I've talked about in Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Serrated Scalpel, where there's a bit where you have to go to a pub and there's three guys that have information, but in order to... Actually, no, it's the bartender who has information, but he says, well, I'm not going to give you this information until you beat me at darts, but I'm not going to let you play darts with me until you beat these three other guys. So you have to beat three guys at darts and then beat the bartender at darts, and then he gives you the information, but the information turns out to be useless and completely not relevant to your investigation. So it's like you've wasted all this time on this puzzle that you think is going to get you somewhere, but it ends up not getting you anywhere. And that's frustrating.
What a strange game.
Yeah. So, I mean, for my case, is like it's different because it would lead you somewhere, because eventually that puzzle would get you a suspect. It's just maybe not the right suspect. But, yeah, it's like, okay, so how do I balance this? Because I don't want it to be just like, oh, well, it's super easy to get this. I mean, there's some cases where it is super easy to reach a conclusion, but that conclusion is obviously the wrong one. So, yeah.
Something I think it's I don't have a lot of experience with designing optional stuff beyond, like, fun optional stuff, you know?
Right.
So, you know, I have done games where there's optional stuff, but never to that sort of thing where, oh, you identified the wrong suspect. This changes everything. I've never done that far. Right. So I really don't have the context and experience to see or to sort of have any insight as to the benefits or the challenges there. But I definitely think that it's a whole new thing that you're playing in terms of learning to design things. You've given yourself a challenge of designing stuff. You know, and obviously there were choices that you could make at the end of Ben Jordan and, you know, in a Golden Wake and stuff, but never to that extent.
Right.
So I think it's a big challenge, you know.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. We'll see. Anyway.
That's the real challenge of adventure game puzzles, is designing a good one.
That's true. That's very true. And on that note, I think we should wrap it up.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's hard to it's one of those topics where it's hard to get to a stopping point and go, yeah, we've summed that up.
We solved the puzzle of challenging puzzles.
It's one of those topics where, like, you know, especially for me now, because I've been an artist for 3.5 years.
Mm.
Or something like that. Like, artist and animator, that's been my focus.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm rusty in a lot of other areas, and I'm discovering that now that I'm, like, playing around with puzzle design and writing and coding and stuff, a lot of stuff that I used to think about all the time, I haven't thought about that stuff for a long time, and I'm rediscovering a lot of challenges
mm-hmm.
that I had not forgotten, but that I haven't been sort of facing as a daily or weekly or monthly thing
right.
for several years, you know, mm-hmm. and I feel less qualified to talk about it mm-hmm. from a designer's point of view. I can talk about it from a player's point of view, but that's, you know, so I, yeah, my input is kind of with a grain of salt.
Yeah, so is mine, really. It always is.
I guess that's the thing, yeah, but yeah, it's one of those things where I feel like sort of 3 years ago, I'd been thinking about this constantly for years. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was mentally fit to discuss it. And I feel like I've I've learned a lot since, but learning about stuff and actually doing it are two totally different things.
That's very true.
You know, so that's there's no substitute true. For experience, and I'm kind of lacking in that at the moment for this sort of stuff.
Oh, well. All right, well, good. That's been our podcast. Thanks for listening. If you want to find us on the internet, you can find me on Twitter at Brundislav Games.
I am at Ben_304, and together,
we are at BCT underscore
podcast. I couldn't remember if it had the underscore, so I was waiting.
That was a challenge there. Anyway, yeah.
That was my fault because I couldn't remember if it had an underscore or not.
It's okay. Thanks for listening. Bye.
Goodbye.